Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Hope you're doing well this very beautiful Thursday. We have a packed show today. We're going to talk with Congressman Hanson Clark. His term in Congress is ending, so we want to find out what's it really like on Capitol Hill. And Governor Snyder yesterday proposed an almost 600-mile walking trail that would take you from Detroit right on up to Wisconsin. Could this really happen? And we'll look at what's making headlines from the L.A. Auto Show. But first, it appears a regional transit authority for Southeast Michigan is one step closer to becoming reality. This week, the state Senate passed a bill to create the authority for Macomb, Oakland, Washtenaw, and Wayne counties. Possible routes could include Detroit to Birmingham, Detroit to Ann Arbor, and Troy to Mount Clemens. An authority like this could also accept federal funding for transportation projects, projects like the proposed M1 high-speed passenger rail system along Woodward Avenue. Republican State Senator Tom Casperson sponsored this legislation.
There's a lot of history behind this thing, and I think it's monumental if we get this done.
And when Casperson talks about a lot of history, he is indeed correct. It has been decades in the making, trying to hammer out a workable, viable, efficient system of public transportation in Southeast Michigan, something proponents say can only help the economy of our whole state. Joining us now, Jack Lesenberry, Michigan Radio's senior political analyst, and Daniel Howes, business columnist at the Detroit News. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Jack, I'd like to start with you. Let's talk some about this history, so much of it political. Why has this issue been kicking around for some 40 years and there is still no regional transit authority?
Well, it's nothing to do with the technology, of course, Cindy. It has to do with politics and racial politics. Detroit versus the suburbs. Detroit has its bus system. The suburbs have theirs. They're not coordinated. They're not merged. And from time to time, efforts were made. People would go to the Mackinac Island Conference and talk about this, and then they'd come back, and the good feeling would dissipate. They did actually pass a law 10 years ago, which Governor Engler vetoed as almost his last act before leaving office. And there was a lot of lack of trust on both sides, worry that one side was going to get the better of the other. But now I think that there's maybe more of a climate of realism. But this is not through the legislature yet.
And Daniel, I'm sure the bottom line is the impact on citizens, especially in Detroit, standing on street corners for buses that never come.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think the other thing, I agree with everything Jack said earlier, but I think the real questions are also ones of control and money. And both from taxpayer money and also from the federal government. What's been happening in Detroit for so long is really deplorable, I think, in all of Southeast Michigan. We're the largest metro area in the country that doesn't have a regional transit system, and we should. And we continue to fight about the same things over and over and over again. And there are some examples of where regionalism has started to work. And we're going to see it at the upcoming auto show, where they're going to unveil the redone Popo Center under a regional authority. It's been something that they've been fighting about between the city and the suburbs for generations. It got to be such a joke that I would write a column and say, it's December and it's time for another Cobo Hall plan. And and now we've finally gotten our arms around that. So I think, to Jack's point, there is some change in the politics between Republican and Democrat, and a lot of people recognize that something needs to be done, but whether they're actually going to do it, I think, still remains to be seen.
Well, Jack, can you tell us, please, how is it a conservative Republican lawmaker from the Upper Peninsula came to sponsor this bill for a transit authority in Southeast Michigan?
Well, it's kind of heartening, I think, that Tom Casperson, who's certainly been one of the more conservative members of the legislature, both in the House and the Senate, went to Detroit and tried to get around taking a bus in the wintertime last winter and stood on a street corner at one point for 45 minutes, and he finally got on a bus, and nobody was talking about politics or talking about freezing, and he realized this didn't make any economic sense. So I think that's sort of heartening. You would have thought this might have come more from Republicans in the suburbs. There are people, my dry cleaner, for example, in Detroit suburbs has been looking for someone to work there. There's a lot of people in Detroit who might like that job, but they have no transportation to get there, and that is a pattern all over the metro area.
Which really leads us into discussing, if this comes together, the difference it would mean for the lives of people, especially Detroit and people in Southeast Michigan. I don't think you can even describe the difference it could make to have a reliable transportation system.
Well, I think that's the case. But again, we don't know how all the bugs would be worked out. As I understand it, and Dan can correct me if I'm wrong, this would be an overlay. This would not abolish either SEMCOG or the Detroit transportation system. It would there would be a new system of rapid buses. It would go throughout the metro area, and maybe it's times, maybe eventually they'd phase out some of the other lines. But right now, this would be an overlay on top of the existing system. It would be paid for by millages that would have to be approved by the voters of all these counties. So it's a multi-stage process. Even once it gets through the House.
That's exactly right, and I think there's no guarantee that the millages will pass. I mean, I think increasingly people, a lot of voters are very skeptical of additional expenditures of money, and when you look at the kind of system that's being proposed, one that overlays another one, there's a lot of duplicative costs there, and I think a lot of taxpayers would look at that and be very skeptical of something like that. And, you know, Washtenaw County has basically reversed itself for the time being because they're trying to preserve what they've developed as a very good transit system that is able to avail itself of federal money because it is so well managed. These problems are not only political, but they're also ones of management. And as long as you're going to have competing managements, you're going to continue to have a lot of these problems.
I think the more immediate threat probably is Macomb County in the Detroit area. Washtenaw would be nice, but it's a bit off the beaten track of the commuter patterns of most Detroiters. But Macomb County might be most resistant to this. Wayne probably would be the easiest sell. Mm-hmm. But they managed to sell Macomb on voting for an art authority to fund the DIA, which at one point I thought was not very likely. So, again, it's going to take some selling. It's going to take... First of all, this has to get through the House, and it's not just suburban and outstate Republicans who will vote against this, some of them. There are some Detroiters who, Dan very sagely said it was an issue of control. There are some people from Detroit who don't want anything, even if it benefits them, if they don't control it.
Which we have seen plenty of, Belle Isle and on and on and on. So do you both think the bill could pass the State House? What do you think the likelihood is, Dan?
Well, I think clearly you've had some wrangling and some resistance from the Detroit delegation if they don't get proper representation. And you, on the other side, you see people like from suburban Wayne County that are saying they want to make sure that the Wayne County representation doesn't all go to Detroit. And I think that's going to be an issue that's going to have to be defined and laid out. I think there's a decent chance, and I think it will help, that Governor Snyder is probably going to be whipping this a little bit. And he tends to be a little less archly political than on these kinds of issues because he's just trying to fix what he calls are the problems or what he identifies as the problems. And I think he's come to the conclusion that regional transit for Southeast Michigan is very important from an economic development standpoint and for people to get to work, as we've been talking about. And I think he's right.
If I could add something, if I could add something to what Dan said, I think I agree. I think the chances now are probably better than 50%, and not just because of Governor Snyder, but even more importantly in the legislative context. Paul Opsahmer, who is the chair of the House Transportation Committee, a Republican, is for this. And he hasn't always marched in lockstep up with Snyder, but it's important to remember if they don't get this done in the lame duck session, they have to start all over at the beginning next January.
Oh boy, oh boy. Finally, while I have you both here, could I get your thoughts on the news that Detroit's bond ratings have been cut even more by Moody's? Jack, more of the same bad news?
I mentioned this to someone this morning who said they weren't aware Detroit still had a bond rating. So, I mean, I think this is just a blow falling on a bruise.
And it's more of the same. I mean, Detroit's bond rating is about as far down as it can go, and they are creeping ever steadily closer to a Chapter 9 bankruptcy filing. I've been spending a lot of time studying that and writing about it, and I think a lot of people may say bankruptcy is not an option, but it may become ultimately the only option left for the state. The other thing that we're going to see is what happens in lame duck in their efforts to revise the emergency manager law, because that's going to be about the only thing that is going to be able to keep them out of bankruptcy, I think.
And I think it's been clear from both of you and other people we've spoken to on stateside that it is not just a Detroit problem. That tidal effect is going to spread throughout the entire state if Detroit goes under, correct?
Yep.
Well, a lot to keep an eye on. Both of you, thank you so much. Daniel Howes, business columnist at the Detroit News, and Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's senior political analyst. Let's turn now to Rick Pluta, Lansing bureau chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. He's at the state capitol and keeping an eye on a very, very busy day in the legislature's lame duck session. Rick?
The Regional Transit Authority is certainly high on the to-do list here, Cindy, but what's hanging over everything, every issue, is the question of whether the legislature will take up a right-to-work bill in the lame duck session. Some Republicans think voter rejection of Proposal 2, that was the labor rights question on the November ballot, that's an invitation to do just that. Unions are trying to get their members out and here over to the Capitol to lobby against this possibility, and it is still only a possibility. No legislation has been introduced at this point to make Michigan a right-to-work state. Cindy, I spoke with Joyce Stein, a retired nurse from Jackson, and she's here saying don't do it to every lawmaker she can talk to.
You know, if we're starting to turn the corner of this recession, we shouldn't during lame duck, you know, have a bunch of bills that are going to hurt workers. And I think it's a backdoor movement. You know, if they want to consider this, they need to do it next year. They need to meet with their constituents and talk about it openly, not behind back doors.
Some Democratic legislators are saying they won't vote for anything without assurances right to work isn't on the lame duck agenda. Governor Snyder, House Speaker Jace Bolger, they say it certainly won't happen today, but this lame duck session still has another week or two to go.
Thanks, Rick. That's Michigan Public Radio's Rick Pluta reporting from the state capitol, sounding very, very busy there. Also today, a state House panel rejected a proposal to create a state-run online health insurance exchange. Well, that's where you could compare and buy health insurance plans. The House Health Policy Committee defeated the health exchange legislation by a 9-5 vote. The state Senate had approved a bill, but the House delayed action because its Republican majority opposes the federal Affordable Health Care Act. Still to come, media previews are underway at the LA Auto Show. We'll look at what's turning heads. How about a car that could change color depending on your mood? That's in 20 minutes. You're listening to Michigan Radio, and this is Stateside. If you love biking or hiking or snowmobiling, Governor Snyder and the DNR have got a gift for you. The governor unveiled it during his special message on energy and the environment yesterday. How does this strike you? A 599-mile trail that would stretch from Belle Isle right on up through the UP to Wisconsin. Here to tell us more is Ronald Olson. He's chief of the DNR Parks and Recreation Division. Welcome. Ron, how much of this already exists and how much would need to be constructed?
Well, the way we estimate it, as a crow flies, it covers about 600 miles, as was described. But the actual trail itself, once you go around the lake shores and other things and the circuitous routes it's likely to take using existing trails, and that may total up to as much as 923 miles of actual trail.
What would it take for you to be able to complete the trails? Is there private land that would have to be acquired, or is this public land? How would you do this?
Oh, yeah, it's all that. There's private land in between. We may have to go around and utilize other public rights of ways that may exist. We may need to partner with local jurisdictions, as we do on many of the trails that pass through counties and townships and cities. So these are things that we're going to have to really work hard on, as we have done in the past, to develop the many trails that we already do have.
And talking money, how much money would this cost? And is the money available, or would you have to do millages, or is the money there?
No. Right now, we're going to have to figure out what kind of funding opportunities. A lot of this will seek partnerships, grants. We do get some trail funds from the federal government, and we do have some statewide funds that we utilize, but there is no yet-defined potted money, so it's yet to be determined what the total expense would be.
If you could have your way, how long would it be before we have that trail to enjoy?
Well, I guess, you know, depending on priorities and how things go, it'd be great to be able to have this virtually complete in the next 3 or 4 years, something like that, maybe 5 years max. Sometimes it may go longer, but you said in an ideal circumstance that would be ideal if we could substantially get this connected in the next 3 to 5 years.
I have no doubt that this idea did not just pop into Governor Snyder's mind and get served up in his address this week. So who came up with this idea of connecting all of this and making this a reality?
Well, we've been working a lot in downtown Detroit. We have Milliken State Park down there. We have the DeQuinder Cut. And we just dedicated the Globe Building, which is going to be an outdoor adventure center, which sits right at the terminus of the DeQuinder Cut, which there was just recently a grant allocated to extend that trail up to the Eastern Market. And the vision is to take that trail and connect it out to the urban area of Southeast Michigan and continue it on forward. And then the idea was, well, what if we could connect this trail system to the Mackinac Bridge? And then, of course, from that, it said, well, why not across the Upper Peninsula? With the discussion with the governor and creating a striving vision, I think people said, well, why not connect both of them together and have a big goal of Detroit to Wisconsin? So it's kind of it's been something that's been discussed in segments, but I think now it's really packaging it together as a strong, striving vision.
So it's taking a what if and mixing in a governor who's open to it and presents it, and so now you're off to the races to make it happen.
Yes, and one of the big front door messages, we want to make Michigan the trail state and identify our many miles of trail opportunities, the variety of things from motorized to unmotorized, et cetera, to make Michigan a trail state and a trail destination for tourists. And this does show another light on the importance of connecting trails to be able to get from one major place to another.
But it certainly opens up some fun options for spending time in Michigan, and we can all start training our bicycle muscles right now.
There you go.
Thank you so much for talking with us today. Ronald Olson, Chief of the DNR Parks and Recreation Division.
Okay, thank you.
Right about now, in homes all across Michigan, high school juniors and seniors and their parents are knee-deep in the college search, taking those ACTs and SATs, visiting college campuses, trying them on for size, writing the perfect application essay, waiting for the letter that says, congratulations, and in virtually every home, trying to figure out how on earth to pay for college. But there is one place in America where parents do not have to wrestle with that thorny question of paying for college. There is one city in the country where if you graduate from that city's high school, you get to go to college free. And that city is Kalamazoo. It's been 7 years now since an anonymous donor or donors made a promise to kids who graduated from the city's high schools to pay their college tuition. It's called The Promise, and cities across America are watching closely, trying to gauge its power and success. Ted Fishman wrote about The Promise for The New York Times recently. He joins us from his Chicago office. Ted, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, I'm so glad to be with you and to talk about the Kalamazoo Promise.
This promise is unusually straightforward and elegant in its design. Tell us how it's structured.
It's simple. If you go through the Kalamazoo Public Schools, and they have to be the Kalamazoo Public School District Schools, and you graduate from high school, provided you've been there 3 years or more in the system, you get money for college. If you've gone all the way from kindergarten, you get all the tuition money paid for. It has to be a Michigan State school. And then the amount reduces in small increments all the way up to your sophomore year of high school. So if you finish your sophomore year of high school only in Kalamazoo, I think you get 60 or 65% of your tuition.
As you looked into The Promise for the piece you wrote for the New York Times, how impressed were you personally with the impact of The Promise on the lives of these public school students?
I was deeply moved by the whole thing. I was moved by the act of philanthropy, which simply said, you know, the kids in Kalamazoo are valuable and loved, and they will get this gift of education. But more deeply than that, I was moved by how the fact of the promise made the town, the city, re-examine what it is and what it can do for itself. So if the promise just existed on its own and children just went to school, it would already be a tremendous program. But what Kalamazoo said for its own is, if we invest as much as we can in the effort to prepare students for college, then we will make the most of its gift. It didn't need to do that. The promise says nothing about what the town ought to do, and yet it set itself this goal of pushing more kids towards graduation, improving the test scores, getting the most for the tuition money that was coming their way.
And so give us some more into what the city did for students, obviously starting when they're quite young, right?
Yeah, and that's changing. So the original wave of attention came towards the public schools. How can the public schools improve? How do you create a culture among parents to tell parents that their children have to be college ready? How do you create an attitude among the children that the quality of their scholarship in school affects what they will get 12 years later when they graduate? You know, so how do you start talking to kindergarteners, first, second, third graders about college as part of their future? And that's not a trivial that's not a trivial chore, because, you know, in Kalamazoo, lots of the families had no college culture whatsoever. And, you know, lots of things that middle-class families and above might take for granted about aiming for those goals really needed to be inculcated into the culture of much of the town. It, you know, Kalamazoo is a prosperous industrial town by many measures, but it's also one of America's poorest places by other measures. One out of three children in the school system is poor, is officially poor, and many more than that are near poor. And college just simply hadn't been on the radar of those families because they didn't hold out hope of it. Now they can.
The way you described it, when the youngsters got word of this promise that had been made in this donation, the kids began crying. That is extremely moving.
And when you hear the children talk about it, you know, what it means for them, how it shifted their future. You know, I talked to many of the graduates of the first wave of recipients of the program, and vistas opened for them that they had never imagined. Hmm. You know, one thing that's really interesting about the promise, it's a scholarship for anything you want to study. If you're getting a scholarship from some other source, often it's for math or science or something practical, and you have to be a good student, they're merit scholarships, or they're need-based scholarships.
Right.
Here, if you want to study the arts, if you want to study film, if you want to study engineering, if you want to go into, if you want to learn how to illuminate a medieval manuscript and that's your passion, there's a full tuition scholarship for you at the end of high school.
And to date, you reported that the promise has paid out $35 million for post-secondary study and about 2,500 students. So how has that impacted the graduation rate and the dropout rate for Kalamazoo schools?
You know, it has not influenced the dropout rate that much. So the number of students who don't make it to the end, or the percentage of students who don't make it to the end, is still about the same as it was when the promise began, and that's disheartening.
The ones who are going, though, it's amazing to think that they have the that latitude to pick their passion, go after it, and know that tuition is covered, and also that they have 10 years to get this done, so the clock isn't ticking, and if you have to take time out to help the family out, you can do that.
And that came late, Cynthia. When the promise was originated, they didn't expect the students to take so long to graduate, but because they weren't thoroughly college ready, because life sometimes intrudes, it became clear in those early years of the program that students would be stopping and starting in college, so they needed to give them that 10-year window.
If you've just joined us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, speaking with writer Ted Fishman, who profiled The Promise for the New York Times recently. This is happening in Kalamazoo, where a donor is paying the college tuition of youngsters who graduate from Kalamazoo Public Schools. Ted, any idea who the mystery donor is?
The town, most people in the town feel pretty confident they know who it is, but it's kind of at the urban myth level of knowledge. You know, there are some wealthy families in Kalamazoo. One of them is the Stryker family, and the Stryker family founded and still has a role in a very large industrial company that makes prosthetic joints and hospital beds and
yes,
other devices for healthcare. And several members of the family had roles in the Kalamazoo Public Schools in their youth. So people put those facts together and say maybe it's them. You know, one thing I think it's kind of fun to speculate on is what would the town think if they learned that it wasn't a local person who has direct contact with and love for the children? What if you learned it was an ideologue or a foreign monarch? There's just for fun, I thought about what if it were the king of Saudi Arabia, because Western Michigan University has a very large Saudi contingent of students there, and wonder if this were a form of thank you. Would you think differently? Would the schools respond differently if the king of Saudi Arabia funded it? Now, I don't think that's likely, but nobody knows. The donor's anonymous.
I know that there's even some speculation it could be one very famous New York Yankee.
Yeah, well, it might be, but...
Mr. Derek Jeter,
yeah,
right?
Mr. Because Derek Jeter, who's from Kalamazoo and has a foundation that does help Kalamazoo students in some important ways. But if you look at his income, it's just he just doesn't have enough money to be the sole sponsor. He might be one of a group, but it's all speculation. That's part of the magic, though, because it leaves the agenda of the promise up to the community that receives it, and it's not top-down.
It's not top-down, yeah. Is there anything like the promise being started up in other cities and towns?
Yes, there's more than a dozen around the country. And one happy result of the New York Times article is that I received a lot of correspondence from other communities that are thinking about it and thinking of rallying it. And they don't all need, you know, a single group or a single family of donors. You can collect money from all kinds of sources and create it. It's expensive, but it's not unaffordable. You know, one of the calculations in the piece is what would it take for New York City to have a Kalamazoo Promise type program? It would take about $20 billion for that. Well, there's 53 billionaires in New York City. They don't have to be the only donors, but they alone could fund it, and some of them have well north of $1 billion. You know, you could see a lot of Promise programs around the country.
I think the way you phrase this as a very important social experiment was well put. What in your heart did you feel that this social experiment was trying to prove?
I think for me it is this community aspect of it. I'm very interested in what is the economic and social value of a community that has booster values, that really promotes its own, that communicates to its own that we love each other, that we're in it together, that there is a sense of the public. And what the Kalamazoo Promise does is it takes a giant piece of private philanthropy and it uses it as a spur for public action. And it's a rare experiment. It's rare in its scale, and it's rare in, you know, how the focus on children has really spread to being a communal focus on all things. For the community to succeed, it's decided that school alone is not enough. It has to address housing, health care, diet. These are the only ways you can maximize the gift. If the children do well on all these fronts, and their parents also have to be well-fed, healthy, and so on. So it's public health in its most broad speaking, and it's the community responding to this private gift in that way. I think it's a very, very fascinating spur of local democracy.
Fascinating, fascinating piece. Is there any end time to this? Is this just going to go on and on and on?
You know, I've heard conflicting stories about that. I think the latest and most reliable is that there is enough money in the promise to fund it in perpetuity. So it's there. It's there to be an example for all of us. It's there to have time to work. There's a lot of philanthropy in the country, which is on a clock. But when you're dealing with problems that have unfolded over generations, you probably need generations to solve them, or at least one generation. And the Kalamazoo Promise is committed to that.
It'll be fascinating to see how this does play out as there's been 7 classes now, right?
That's right. And the graduation rates are good. They're better than the national average. And if you think education in any form is a value, then you might be heartened by the fact that 90% of the recipients of Promise money have had at least some college education, which ought to provide them a boost in any rate, even if they don't graduate.
Ted Fishman, thanks so much for sharing your insights with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Writer Ted Fishman did a piece about the Promise for the New York Times recently. We'll put a link to that piece on our website at michiganradio.org. Still to come, what is it really like to be a member of Congress? As his term comes to an end, we ask that very question of Congressman Hanson Clark. And then we spotlight a local hero. That's coming up in 15 minutes here on Stateside. The auto show season begins this week. The Los Angeles show marks the start of the North American auto show season. Of course, those of us in Michigan like to feel that the North American International Auto Show that happens every January at Cobo Center in downtown Detroit is the auto show. But the LA show will set the tone for the season, and there are up to a million people expected. NPR's Sonari Glinton is in LA to cover the show. Sonari, what makes the LA auto show different from Detroit's?
The North American International Auto Show in Detroit is the most important one that I can think of, definitely the most important one in the U.S. However, this is the first one, and so it's the first one, and it's right before the luxury and SUV car season, and it also is the place where the automakers sort of put their greenest foot forward, where they talk about their green technology.
And certainly, as you pointed out, when one thinks of the West Coast and cars, green comes to mind. So this LA Auto Show is important for car makers to trot out their green technology. What are you seeing that you're impressed with?
I'm really impressed by the German luxury automakers who are introducing diesel cars. You know, Porsche has its SUV, it's going to be diesel. Audi, almost all of its cars have a diesel option, because diesel gets such a higher fuel economy.
We certainly know with rigid standards on the West Coast, that is a big thing. But in the rest of America, do people really want these kinds of technologies, or do they want what they know and love?
Every time we look at surveys and we ask people what they want, they will say fuel economy, right? They will check the box that says fuel economy.
Right.
But, you know, how you fill out a survey doesn't translate into how you buy cars. What we're finding is that people want the most fuel-efficient version of the car they have, or that they're looking for, right?
Yeah.
So if you want an SUV, you're not going to be like, hey, I want a two-door car.
I want a Fiesta. You know? I want something tiny. Yeah.
You want to get your category, you want to get the most fuel-efficient version of the thing you're already looking at. So, you know, Nissan, for instance, has the Nissan Altima that's new. It's the most fuel-efficient car in the mid-sedan size. Mm-hmm. So people who are looking at mid-size sedans may be drawn to that car that gets, you know, 35-plus miles a gallon. That's how people are making their choices. So people do want fuel efficiency. They just don't want to change too much in their life to get there. And the car makers now are realizing that. And that is why, you know, from SUV to subcompact car, they're offering, you know, greater fuel economy.
In the last moment we have with you, Sonari, I know there was an advanced technology showcase through the media preview days. Is there any cool, fun technology that you've seen that might make it into the cars we drive in the near future?
You know, here's what's funny about car shows. The technology is the thing that's going to be 18 months away. I mean, the things that I'm seeing that are really interesting is the skin on your car, the paint on your car, changing with your mood. Say you want to, you know, advertise, you know, stateside with Cynthia Canty. That is somewhere in our future where our car will reflect what we do, our mood. And you won't have to go out and buy a brand new car. It'll just be the skin on the car will change. Like, today I want a red car.
Okay, I got to tell you, totally, every head around here just snapped like, cool. Isn't it funny? We can talk all about green technology and batteries. And everybody just, when you started talking about skins changing color, everybody's like, yeah.
you know, when studies show that the color is often the most important thing to a shopper. I can say we don't have any of the options, but we have the red one, and you'll be like, shoppers are like, okay, as long as I got the red one.
I love it. And of course, I mean, the idea that we could change color of the car depending on the mood or what we want to say that day is pretty enchanting. And that it's pretty amazing that that technology is existing.
Yeah, it's still very, very early in its infancy. But I suspect that that's something, the fact that the head snapped there is a sign that car makers are going to be getting on the road sooner rather than later.
Pretty fun. Sonari Glinton reporting to us from the Los Angeles Auto Show. Thanks for joining us today, Sonari.
Thank you so much.
From L.A. to D.C., or to be more exact, Capitol Hill. We hear countless news reports about Congress, but they're all based on being outside looking in. What's it like on the inside? What is it like to be a member of Congress looking out at us, the American people, as we're so often called in political speeches? We're joined now by someone who is entering his final few weeks as a member of Congress. Hanson Clark was sent to Washington by voters in 2010. But after Michigan lost a seat due to population loss, Congressman Clark had to go head-to-head against fellow Congressman Gary Peters in the primary for Michigan's 14th district, and Peters came out the winner. Congressman Hanson Clark joins us now from Washington. Congressman, when one watches the Sunday morning talk shows or the cable news talk shows, it's hard not to come away with a feeling that partisan divisions are so strong that Democrats don't talk to Republicans and Republicans don't want to be seen talking to Democrats. And there seems to be so much posturing and finger pointing when the cameras and the microphones are on. Can you tell us, what is it like away from the cameras and microphones? Is there a sense of cooperation or conversations across the aisle?
Here's the problem. Many times there's not that cooperation, that both sides, whether it's Republican or Democrats or regardless of your ideology, is that we want to be right about our position and that we won't deviate from that at all.
But is there constructive conversation and movement on issues?
Yes, there is. But it's important for the citizens to demand that politicians that they hire start working for them and stop bashing people just because of political reasons.
It's certainly no secret. I'm not telling you anything you don't know about the approval ratings for American voters. Approval rating for Congress is at 21% just before Election Day, which is certainly up from 10% in August. But it's not a good approval rating. Why do you feel those approval ratings are so dismal?
Well, here's why. It's because in American politics is that politicians believe that the only way that they can prevail is by making their opponent look bad. And my view is the opposite. If you serve the public effectively, that's the way to be able to succeed politically. I think that's so important. But also, too, that's why people pay taxes and hire folks like me. It's to serve them. It's not to score political points.
And so it sounds like you are kind of almost laying down a challenge to voters, to citizens, to really demand and expect that kind of cooperative spirit of their lawmakers.
Absolutely. The lawmaker is in there for one purpose. That's to serve the public collectively, not to score political points. You see, the focus many times in Congress is about staying in Congress as opposed to how can I help other people get a better job? How can I help homeowners stay in their homes even though they're underwater? How can I help a college graduate who sacrificed and worked hard to get out of that unbearable student loan debt so they can go and start their own business, which will create jobs for many other people?
But it does seem the way the system is set up now, from the time that you show up as a newcomer to Congress, you have to keep an eye on being reelected. What would you, now having been through this, what do you think needs to be done to correct this or to fix this so you could really focus on the business of governing, not the business of being reelected?
Politicians will listen to the voters if they feel that they're likely to lose the election if they don't listen. So if the voters say, look, we don't care about politics, we want you as an elected official to work on getting us more jobs here. We need you to work on serving us directly. The politicians will start doing that.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, speaking with Congressman Hanson Clark. Well, let me ask you this. What do you think it means in terms of attracting the best and the brightest to come and serve in Washington in years to come, when you, it kind of gets a sense that it's, there's a meat grinder feeling of, you've got to worry about fundraising, you've got to worry about re-election seems to be always looming. Do you worry that the best and brightest might say, you know what, it's not worth it?
Let me talk to you about what the best and the brightest is for public service.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm the first in my family to go to college. My dad had a third grade education. My mother was a cleaning lady and a school crossing guard. So they didn't, I didn't come from a professional household. I graduated from an Ivy League university, and I have a law degree from Georgetown Law School, and I served in the legislature for over a decade before I went to Congress. So people could say, well, Hanson Clark has a degree and he has a legislative experience, and I'm a lawyer, and I'll likely be teaching law soon, after Congress. But my best qualification is that I was a guy from the neighborhood, and I lost everything that was important to me, my family, my scholarship, my job. I was on food stamps. That was cut off. And at age 23, I gave up hope completely. I'm best qualified because I gave up hope, but it was because of a initiative created by Congress, a job training program. I was able to get a job, and that turned the direction of my life around. So what people really need to serve effectively, they don't need money. They don't need an education. Formally, what they need is a heart to serve the people. And if they've gone through personal experiences that will give them the drive to prevail through political obstacles and give them the determination to keep working even though other political people say they can't accomplish something on behalf of the people, that's what an elected official really needs. They have to have that heart to really work to fight for people against the political system many times. That's what you need.
As you prepare to leave Congress, Congressman Clark, if you could change one thing about the way Congress works or the way one gets to Congress, what would that be?
You know, with all the shortcomings this institution has, it's the best we have on the planet. All we need to do is that we just need to demand that the people that we hire to serve us actually do that. Serve the people, not a political agenda.
Congressman Hanson Clark, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Well, it's great to be on your show, Cindy, and thank you.
Turning now to our weekly salute to a local hero, this week a man from Berkeley. It was over 18 years ago that Chester Zuber and his wife Jean got the phone call every parent dreads. Their 22-year-old daughter Patty had been critically hurt in a car crash in Tennessee. Doctors knew she would not survive those injuries. And they knew something else. Chester Zuber had battled heart disease for years. He had been on a waiting list for a new heart, and doctors offered Chester his daughter's heart. That unbelievable loss and the gift of life that followed sent Chester Zuber down a path of activism. He and his wife have been doing everything they can to encourage others to sign up to be organ donors. Chester, when you were first told that you were tops on the list to receive your daughter Patty's heart, what was your reaction?
Oh, I couldn't believe it. It's nothing that we ever considered and ever thought about. And when the organ donor coordinator told me I could have Patty's heart, you could have knocked me over with a feather. Million things went through my mind. Is this right? Is this ethical? What will other people say? Is this a selfish move? Can I stand every heartbeat reminding me of Patty? And I turned it down without thinking any further.
But you clearly changed your mind. How was it you changed your mind and agreed to accept her heart?
Well, we were leaving a special area where we had been most of the morning, and that's where we got the news that Patty had died. And we had a motel-type room in the hospital. And it was several hours before our flight was ready to leave Knoxville for Detroit. And I thought it best, because I knew when the adrenaline would wear off that I'd be, my energy would be completely exhausted. So I thought it's best that I lay down and before the trip.
Mm-hmm.
While I was waiting for the elevator, and I tell people this with all sincerity, I don't want to sound corny here,
mm-hmm.
But while I was waiting for the elevator, I swear that Patty was pleading with me to accept her gift, her heart.
You could feel it.
I could feel it. I could almost visualize it. She was just above me, just pleading with me.
So you had your whole family behind you saying, Dad, do it, and you really felt your daughter, Patty, pleading with you to take her gift. So you accepted it, and you had the operation.
I'm going in 19 years. It was 18 years last August. I'm into my 19th year, and I feel terrific.
And you and your wife have chosen to be very open and share your story to encourage others to sign up for organ donors. But that must have been a hard decision. It would have been very understandable had you chosen to remain private. Why did you step forward, and why have you made yourself so active?
I realized when I was all through that even though I had been on a heart transplant list for 4 years, I really didn't know everything about organ transplant or very much about organ transplant. And I felt, if I don't know anything about organ transplant, what does the average person in the street know? So I made a promise to myself that if the surgery went well, and if I felt well, I would do everything I possibly could to make people aware of the need and the importance for organ and tissue donation. I hadn't a clue how I was going to accomplish that, but that would be my goal. Little did I realize that the media was as interested as they were in this, and because of that, I've had an opportunity to speak everything from middle schools to high schools to service organizations like the Lions Club, the Rotary. I've even talked at medical symposiums. And what I've realized that what people didn't know much about organ transplant, but they knew all of the fears, myths, and misconceptions surrounding organ donations, and I tried to explain those away.
And you've been put in that position. Chester Zuber, what message would you like our listeners to understand about becoming an organ donor?
I think being an organ donor will give you a special place in heaven, because take it Patty's case. Because of her generosity of wanting to be an organ donor, two blind ladies now have vision. Two others share kidneys. I have her heart, another her liver. Some 50 organ and tissue samples were gathered, which will help in the recovery of victims of accidents, birth defects, burns. And I think that as Patty looks back and down and sees all the good that she has done, she has to be one of the happiest angels in heaven. And even though Patty is gone, she is not dead, because she's alive in so many others. And this can be the silver lining. Heaven forbid that you lose a loved one. But should it happen, and you agree to donate the loved one's organs, they can have the same satisfaction that we do, knowing that something good came from the worst tragedy in the world, losing a child or a loved one, by being an organ and tissue donor. I feel that I've experienced the greatest miracle this side of heaven.
Chester Zuber received the gift of life from his daughter, Patty, over 18 years ago. And you can learn more about becoming an organ donor through the group Gift of Life. You can easily sign up as well for the Michigan Donor Registry, and we have put links to both of these sites on our stateside page at michiganradio.org. Thank you, Chester.
You're welcome.
And we want to hear from you. If you know of a local hero that you think we should spotlight, someone anywhere in Michigan, or if you have a story idea or issue you'd like to hear discussed, let us know. Find us on Facebook at Stateside with Cynthia Canty, on Twitter at Stateside Radio, and of course online at michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Bob Scott engineers the show. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening. Let's talk again Monday.